In addition to the problems that obtain with existing levels and dimensions of governmental involvement with communication and culture, comes that impulse to which reference was made earlier to push more and more of private cultural life into the governmental sector, particularly in the area of control of funds, money so indispensable to it. In the October edition of the New Criterion, a writer observes, "Arts supporters are greatly responsible for the intrusion of government into the funding of culture. The demand for government aid has not come from the private sector because of any real unwillingness on the part of patrons to contribute. Rather, it has resulted from a loss of willingness by the private sector to take responsibility for its own taste and its own decisions." Earlier, the writer of this article has argued that there is a curious combination of elitist and populist sentiment that is driving more and more of cultural activity into the hands of government because of a criticism of private culture that it rests, reposes too much in the hands of elites, particularly rich people who can afford it or afford to patronize it. And second, because of a belief characterized as naive that in some way democratic or political institutions can invest cultural expression with democratic values, can make them expressive of a democratic society without, in fact, either politicizing them or subjecting them to the whims and control of an elite of a different kind. That writer in Volume 2, Number 2 of the New Criterion is Samuel Lipman. Samuel Lipman, who will speak to us, I suspect, today with some authority on the question of governmental subsidy of culture, is, horrors, not a lawyer. He is someone who presumes to speak to questions of culture and politics, not in the usual manner, someone who speaks with authority on these matters from the bar, but gadzooks, as a practitioner. He's a pianist, for God's sake. Samuel Lipman, a native of California, although he holds undergraduate and graduate degrees in political science from the California State University system, is in fact a practicing musician. Juilliard School of Music, pianist with the San Francisco Orchestra, the American Symphony Orchestra's frequent appearances at various music festivals and the like on an ongoing basis. Good Lord, the man's played in Carnegie Hall. He has also made a serious career as a critic of music and the arts. Since 1976, he has been and is the incumbent music critic of Commentary. He writes often in the Times Literary Supplement of London. He is a member of ASCAP, and more than a member of ASCAP, he has received awards from ASCAP for his criticism. Those of you who choose to suspect him will note that he has published in the New York Times Book Review. On the other hand, those who know better realize that he's part of the Philadelphia Society Heritage Foundation connection with my predecessor in the chair this morning, Michael Joyce. He was a member of the Heritage Team for Mandate for Leadership that looked at the National Endowment for the Arts. He has been appointed by President Reagan as a member of the National Council on the Arts, which is the governing body of the National Endowment for the Arts, which is that vehicle so much beloved of Joan Mondale, whose mission it is to arbitrate federal subsidies of the arts. Perhaps most interesting, of the facts about Samuel Lipman's background is his involvement with this publication, The New Criterion, Volume 1, Number 1, September 1982, of which I hold here in my hand. Mr. Lipman is the publisher of this magazine, New on the Horizon, edited by Hilton Kramer, out of offices at 850 7th Avenue, New York, New York, 10019. Subscriptions the year, monthly, $27 cheap. This new publication in our firmament, which opened barely a year ago, with a collective statement by its editors as to its purposes, which included the following passage, which responsibility for which must rest, at least in part, with Samuel Lipman. Many writers on the left, and this includes a good many of our prominent critics, too, have never forgiven history for failing to conform to the fictions of radical prophecy. They have never forgiven American society for failing to live up to their critique of it. In some tender sanctum of the soul, socialism remains their moral and social ideal, but a socialism so immune to historical contingency and moral reality that it is now indistinguishable from a religious dogma. It would therefore break their hearts and shatter every illusion they have inherited from the sacred traditions of radicalism to have to acknowledge that capitalism, for all its many flaws, has proved to be the greatest safeguard of democratic institutions and the best guarantee of intellectual and artistic freedom, including their intellectual and artistic freedom, that the modern world has given us.
Thank you very much. That was a lovely and more than merited introduction. I do want to make clear right at the beginning that I subscribe to every word of at least this material, which has been quoted from the New Criterion. I don't think it's necessary to make any apologies here for talking about art on an occasion devoted to speech and its protection under our Constitution. Not only does art often use words and thus fall under the most narrow construction of the First Amendment, a strong argument can also be made that art itself is a kind of speech influencing men to thought and action. The proof of the pudding, one might say, is in the repression. An early policy goal of every dictatorship is total control of art in its creation, discussion, and consumption. As we have just seen from Marshall in the case of the conflict-ridden areas of social programs, government interference in the exercise of free speech can take two forms. It can proscribe positions, and it can prescribe them. It is one of the signal discoveries of the welfare state that both proscription and prescription can be most efficiently accomplished not by the police power, but through funding. To pay for one thing and not to pay for another is plainly to exert a powerful and even determining influence on what becomes available for public consumption. And so we come to the problem of official culture in the United States of 1983. For the first 150 years of its existence, our republic enjoyed an almost completely private establishment of art and of its support. Musical institutions were either run for profit or were entirely answerable to their individual patrons. Museums were social obligations, privately discharged for reasons of art, public education, and status. I might add, too, that despite a strong American tradition of free public school education and the energetic founding in the 19th century of land-grant colleges, until a half century ago, elite college and university institutions were almost without exception privately supported and totally privately run. It will come as no surprise to any of you here today that the writ of the New Deal extended even as far as our cultural life. In art, the Works Progress Administration, established the first programs of federal support in American history. Literature, music, the visual arts, and the theater became objects of concern in Washington. And the immense growth in public higher education after World War II not only brought with it increasing competition for private universities. This overbalancing of the public sector created a need for the kind of dollar amounts only the federal government could supply, and a habit of mind which saw public support through tax levy funds as a proper egalitarian replacement for the ill-gotten gains of the capitalist class. Insofar as high culture, that which is elite, permanent, and self-defining, insofar as high culture itself was concerned, direct WPA impact was limited. True, some worthwhile American music was played, a few new public buildings were embellished by some often tawdry murals, and a quantity of agitprop theater did get on the stage. But in fact, WPA was never a program for art so much as it was a program for artists. Like the Order of the Garter, the WPA was not concerned with any nonsense about merit. In the arts as elsewhere, it was an entitlement scheme, with full employment, the name of the game. And the coming of war and rearmament at the end of the 1930s effectively replaced, in the case of the FBA, of the WPA, the notion of soldiers and factory workers for that of artists. Not only did the immense expansion of governmental domestic budgets after 1945 transform American higher education, money now seemed available to support the kind of broad cultural activity governmentally advocated and nourished which had marked the states of Europe as they made their several hundred years transition from feudalism to democracy via aristocracy and the haute bourgeoisie. What had been the outcome of centuries of organic social development in the old country was now felt to be applicable to the inheritors of Andrew Jackson's America. The early 1950s saw the beginnings of what started as educational television and is now well on its way to becoming a fourth entertainment network. At the end of the decade, foundations, notably Ford and Rockefeller, began to enter the cultural field with studies and funding designed at first to show the need for large-scale private support, and then later to demonstrate the inevitability of federal intervention. The outcome in the 1960s, powerfully assisted by Kennedy-era richesse oblige and great society opportunism, was the creation of the twin national endowments, one for the arts and one for the humanities. Their beginnings, as always with controversial government programs, were modest. A few million dollars here, a few million dollars there, all spent for clearly defined national treasures. By the first Nixon administration, with Nancy Hanks at the NEA and Ronald Berman at the NEH, budgets were on the march. By the time of the Gerald Ford interregnum, budgets for each endowment had climbed well over $100 million yearly. What had been the support of national treasures and turnstile attractions under Nixon and Ford became, under Jimmy Carter, an opportunity to use art and learning to implement controversial and often divisive goals of social policy. Access to great art was turned into outreach, a code word for tailoring art to the capacities and incapacities of new and often non-existent audiences. Affirmative action, women's issues, the populist redefinition of art and learning all were brought to bear on government support of the life of the mind. Now we are in the Reagan administration, and the two endowments are in friendly hands. At NEH, we have William Bennett engaging in a valiant effort to return the humanities to the institution bearing their name. He is trying to substitute traditional criteria of scholarly excellence and content for what have often been disguised political advocacy and ideologically attractive mediocrity. At the NEA, Frank Hodsell is presiding over an attempt to restore administrative sanity to an agency ravaged by poor leadership and pressure from Capitol Hill and the Carter White House. Despite the heroic efforts of the Office of Management and Budget, and at least of Chairman Bennett at the NEH, appropriations at both endowments have not been cut to any serious extent. As a matter of fact, fiscal 1985 budgets, under strong congressional pressure, show every sign of exceeding 1981 Carter administration goals. All in all, the endowments are the focus of bipartisan congressional approval and seem as solidly rooted in our bureaucratic hierarchy as any other institutions in the American political establishment. I have given this thumbnail sketch of the history of the endowments and their background in order to present a context for the discussion of speech as it relates to public culture. I would now like to move a bit closer to the speech issue by describing for you in a rough way how policies are decided and money is awarded at the endowment I know best, the NEA. For the purposes of this description, the NEA can be divided into four parts: leadership, at the very top politically appointed, staff, either civil service or appointed for fixed periods, peer panels chosen by the staff, and the National Council on the Arts, a 26-member body which is required by law to give advice on all matters of policy to the chairman, advice which he may follow or reject as he sees fit. The work of the NEA is organized by programs ranging from music, literature, opera musical theater, dance and visual arts, to design arts, minority arts, and folk arts. A special niche is occupied by programs which attempt to combine the various art forms and present all of the arts on public television. How, given this administrative matrix, does the work of the NEA get done? On the basis of my own experience as a member of the National Council for the past year, a period during which I have attended something like 80 hours of plenary meetings, and I might add, since I wrote this last week, I have just attended another 20 hours. So it is up to 100 hours of plenary meetings. I must conclude that all rhetoric to the contrary, policies are initiated and decisions are made, surprise, by the staff. These actions, it is true, are subject to a carefully selected input from the artistic field and to sporadic control by a politically appointed leadership anxious, terribly anxious, to avoid the charge of non-professional interference. Artistic decisions are in theory made by the peer panels, experts evaluating experts. But in fact, it must be emphasized that peer panels are chosen by the staff. And in addition, these panel reviewers must make their decisions within previously chosen guidelines. And when they make these decisions are mediated by the staff before they are presented to the National Council and the chairman for final action. The role of the National Council itself is no more weighty than might be expected of a group composed of very part-time, often only partially qualified well-wishers for the arts, a group ill-informed about the literally thousands of matters which come before it, a group without its own staff, as a result, a group inadequately prepared to do what by statute it must. Overall, I regret to say, there is an air of bureaucratic secrecy, with opinions of individual panelists on grants held confidential, as indeed are all National Council discussions of grants themselves. The outcome of all this, despite sporadic and, I believe, praiseworthy attempts to open up the process, the outcome of all this is government by press release. Here, it seems to me, is the first danger to free speech posed by our present government establishment of culture. Decisions confidentially made and kept quiet until the moment of their controlled release to a carefully cultivated and sympathetic press. These decisions are to a vastly greater extent than necessary the product of the work of a few staff people with close ties to well-organized and well-government-financed pressure groups. In this connection, I might mention two specific program areas involving millions of dollars of public funds, which seem to me to have been influenced by the closed circle responsible for policy. I refer first to the decision to continue in defiance of any consideration of the relationship of art and artists to a natural audience, to continue the merging of traditional opera into a loosely defined and weak definition of American musical theater. Mention must also be made of the enormous investment of endowment and government prestige and money in a staff-favored and imposed notion of the avant-garde. This particular brand of trendy exhibitionism goes under the title of the next wave, and I'll further identify it for you by saying that it is associated with the names of the dancer Trisha Brown, the performance artist Laurie Anderson, and the composer Philip Glass. What I have just mentioned might, I suppose, be seen by the kindly disposed as artistic misjudgments rather than imposition of opinion. I am rather more concerned by the present tendency of the endowment to engage in the subsidy of words which appear in our press and periodicals. This year, the NEA has begun to choose short fiction. Much of it is my initial impression, of low quality, to appear on a subsidized basis and bearing the federal imprimatur in newspapers across the country. In the area of art criticism which must inevitably concern itself with projects and artists supported by the NEA, the staff of the endowment shows a strong desire to establish a group of critics who will be obligated to the federal government for recognition, support, and advancement. I am disturbed, too, by the strong tendency I see today for artists to beg the help of government in mandating by law the establishment of a particular style, content, and origin of art. At the moment, this pressure is directed toward the presentation of experimental work done by American artists. At some time in the future, this demand may well be for an anti-experimental art, or for art of a particular political content, or for art produced by particular individuals, interests, and groups. The potential threat here to free speech is clear. It is all the more troubling, given the bloody fate of so many artists in this century, that it should now be the artists themselves who are so happily choosing, as it were, the rope which one day may hang them. I should also mention another manifestation of government culture which touches free speech, and it was earlier quoted from my article in October's New Criterion. I'm talking about the pathetic, and there is no other word to describe it, The pathetic tendency now visible for the private sector to look to government for advice as to just what should be supported by government money. This represents a kind of abdication of individual decision-making to government in general and to the NEA in particular. Government money, we are now told by both corporate and individual patrons, leverages, ugly but accurate word, leverages private money to an ever greater extent every year. The effect of this default of private judgment, of this search for a governmental good housekeeping seal of approval, and I might add that the good housekeeping seal of approval application is not mine. I heard it said in congressional testimony here in New York by Edward Block, vice president of the American Telephone and Telegraph Corporation, that it is governmental good housekeeping seal of approval which corporations need before, ignorant as they are, they can make their philanthropic grants. So the effect of all this is threefold. First, the private sector increasingly supports what the government wants. Second, projects which fail to receive official endorsement face grave and often insuperable difficulties in obtaining private funding. Third, and worst of all, the private sector, which ceases to make its own decisions sooner rather than later, loses both the taste and the will necessary to make any decisions at all. It saddens me to say that government on all levels, federal, state, and local, betrays an unfortunate propensity to welcome this expansion of its control over cultural support. This development bodes ill not just for cultural speech, but for the very future of a pluralistic society. But I must still emphasize that we live as yet in a free society. The problems I have mentioned are, it is true, present in a vegetarian context. They seem a little less pressing since the coming of the present administration. I have alluded to the new mood at the NEH. Even at the NEA, so firmly in the grip of the arts advocacy lobby, faint and tentative signs of progress toward a proper support of art are just barely visible. And I know that's a very highly qualified sentence. But while I do not see an immediate threat to freedom in the present establishment of public culture, I must make clear my feeling that both institutions and activities have been created which provide an infrastructure for future attempts at political manipulation and control. Bureaucratic arrangements, which are now being used to support relatively benign activities, can be used in the future to support malignant ones. Attitude which encourage the looking to government for help and direction can easily be used to produce a willingness to take orders. The idea that the greatest art is created by the greatest availability of money is unfortunately all too close to the idea that artists at heart are only employees. In both the rhetoric and some of the actions of the Carter administration, we saw the beginnings of an instrumental use of culture. Who knows what we may see in some future shift of the political pendulum? Am I then, and here is the difficult question raised at the end of his presentation by Marshall Brager, am I then making an argument for an end to public support of culture in general and of the endowments in particular? And here, if I may mix a metaphor, you will find me waffling on the knife edge. While this solution might seem both efficient and elegant, there are drawbacks to dealing with the problem by simply ruling it out of existence. In politics, I am afraid simplicity isn't all. Let me give you two reasons why I think, why I'm afraid, we are stuck for the time being with public support of culture. Some good does indeed come from official support. Few of us would urge the abolition of public libraries, public museums, and the public school system. National treasures, the achievements of our own, I said few. National treasures, the achievements of our own and other civilizations, must be preserved for those who will follow us. The materials of culture and knowledge must be made available to those who, regardless of social origin, want and are able to use them. Society, acting through a government which must be its servant, can be a patron of last resort when private sectors of our society are, for periods of time, not bearing certain important responsibilities. I have another reason, a practical one, for opposing the abolition at this time of the public support of culture. Whether or not we, as friends of free speech and political liberty, oppose such support or not, it will go on anyway. This support is by now thoroughly embedded in our political system. Powerful interest groups are organized on its behalf, and many ravenous clients have been created by the mere existence of funds. Just because official aid to culture will continue, it is necessary that we as conservatives concern ourselves with how that money is to be spent. We must propose serious guidelines for how the money should properly be expended in order to limit the possible damage to free speech, of which we, it seems, are now the only ones cognizant. So I would suggest to you that my brief analysis here today leads in a fairly clear direction for public policy. Detailed, hard-headed public examination of programs, constant application of the tests of liberty to government actions and their effects, a constant attempt to shore up the sophistication and independence of private decisions, a commitment to paring down rhetoric and eliminating the demagogy of promising everything to everybody. These are our imperatives in culture, as everywhere in political life. Above all, we must struggle for modest and more modest government programs, not more programs, but more modest programs. Programs small and clearly stated in self-limiting language, positing rational goals. Only in this way can we be sure that government will play its proper role in supporting art and in supporting free speech for the sake, and I think Walter Burns is right, of Republican government. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lippman.